I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's May 31st, and we have a lot to talk about. Today, I'm on my way to National Harbor, Maryland, just outside of Washington, D.C., where I'll be attending the Consortium of Multiple Sclerosis Centers annual meeting. And I'm actually going to be doing the next episode of Real Talk MS directly from the National MS Society's booth in the conference exhibit hall. So if you're attending the Consortium of MS Centers annual meeting, or CMSC as it's known, I hope you'll come over and join me in the exhibit hall at the MS Society's booth this Thursday, June 2nd at 5 p.m. Eastern Time and be a part of a bonus episode of Real Talk MS. One of the people that I'm looking forward to meeting up with at the CMSC meeting is Dr. Jiwon Oh. Dr. Oh is a neurologist, scientist, and medical director of the Barlow Multiple Sclerosis Program at St. Michael's Hospital at the University of Toronto. Dr. Oh is also the principal investigator of a long-term extension study of a potential treatment for MS called tolebrutinib. Tolebrutinib is one of a new category of MS medications called BTK inhibitors, and I recently had an opportunity to catch up with Dr. Oh and get a quick download about what she learned as a result of her study. In a moment, we'll hear my conversation with Dr. Jiwon Oh. Last month at the American Academy of Neurology annual meeting, pharmaceutical company Sanofi presented data from the long-term extension study for tolebrutinib, a potential treatment for MS that falls under a new category of MS medications called BTK inhibitors. Joining me to update us is the principal investigator for that study, Dr. Jiwon Oh. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Oh.
Thank you very much, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
To start us off, can you explain what a BTK inhibitor is and what the benefits of BTK inhibitors are?
Sure. So BTK inhibitors are a new class of molecule that are being intensely studied in people with MS. BTK stands for Bruton's tyrosine kinase. And these BTK inhibitors are essentially a class of molecule that affect this enzyme known as Bruton's tyrosine kinase. And BTK has a number of functions in the body, but the ones that are relevant to MS are that it modulates B lymphocytes, which we know have an important role in causing MS and causing MS disease activity. In addition, BTK inhibitors seem to have a role in modulating components of the innate immune system, specifically cells known as microglia and macrophages. And we're really interested in the ability to affect these cells in MS because we think that they're the cells that are responsible for the progressive neurological disability that we often see in people living with MS. So there's a lot of excitement about BTK inhibitors in the MS world, because there's hope that they may be able to have beneficial effects that the current treatments that we have do not yet have.
Well, as I mentioned a moment ago, you're the principal investigator for the phase 2B tolebrutinib extension study. So first, I'm hoping you'll explain to our listeners what an extension study is, and then please tell us what you and your team learned in this study.
Sure. So tolebrutinib is one of the BTK inhibitors that's currently being studied in MS. And it's a really interesting molecule because we know that it gets into the central nervous system, which is obviously very important because, you know, the pathological immune cells in MS are in the central nervous system. So this study that we reported on is the extension study of the phase two study that looked at the effect of tolebrutinib in people with MS. In general, an experimental drug goes through many phases of drug development before it can be used in a particular disease. And so tolebrutinib has already demonstrated beneficial effects in people with MS in a phase two study. And phase two studies are generally thought of as a proof of concept study where a molecule is tested in a group of people with a specific disease. In this situation, it's people with MS. And in the phase two study, which was for a duration of 16 weeks, tolebrutinib showed a beneficial effect on MRI measures that we know are important in people with MS. So specifically, there's something called gadolinium-enhancing lesions, as well as new T2 lesions that we look for on MRI, because these are MRI measures of MS disease activity. And in the phase two study that lasted for 16 weeks, tolebrutinib at the largest dose that was tested, which was 60 milligrams, showed a significant effect on lowering the number of gadolinium-enhancing lesions and new T2 lesions in people with MS. So this study, after that initial 16-week period, continued to follow those same patients for a total duration of approximately 72 weeks. And it's very important, you know, after a pretty short phase two study to continue to follow patients, because you want to continue to see that the drug is, number one, safe, and that the drug continues to have a beneficial effect. So in this 72-week extension of that original phase two study, generally what we found was that, number one, the vast majority of people, so 94% of patients, stayed in the study for the full 72 weeks. So this speaks to kind of the tolerability and the safety and likely the efficacy of tolebrutinib. And in general, what was found was that the clinical measures of disease activity that we focus on in MS, which are relapse rate and disability. So relapse rate remained quite low throughout the extension study at 0.17, which is a very low level. And then the disability level remained stable in people across the 72 weeks. So this was reassuring from a clinical standpoint. And then from a safety standpoint, there were no new safety signals that emerged. So all of this is very reassuring, and these people are continuing to be followed. So we'll have additional information in the upcoming year or two.
And with this information, is that what leads up to a phase three study, which is something that is usually much, much larger in scope?
So actually, the phase three trials have already started. Based on the results of that initial 16-week phase two study, that's when the phase three trials began. And as you said, phase three trials are much larger. Most of the studies, there's actually four phase three clinical trials that are currently recruiting right now with tolebrutinib. And each of those studies is approximately 1,000 patients. And so, yes, you're right in the sense that, you know, an initial phase two trial should show a good effect of a drug before the phase three trial can be launched. But because that, you know, 16-week trial period is already over and tolebrutinib very clearly showed an effect, that's why the phase three trials are already happening. But this extension study is really important because at least in this 120 so people, we can follow them over a longer period, just to get an idea of, you know, durable efficacy and safety with tolebrutinib.
Before I'd let you go, I'd like to get your thoughts on one other aspect of clinical research. There's a lot of conversation and actually some concrete steps taken toward involving patients not only as data sources, but involving patients and caregivers in other aspects of clinical research, everything from trial design to recruitment to having a role in disseminating the outcome of the study that they're a part of. What are your thoughts on, I guess, what we can call this evolving paradigm?
I think it's an incredibly important component of clinical research that we are now only beginning to recognize. You know, and I think medicine and science is generally evolving so that patients are really partners in the journey. And I think we can say this clearly for clinical care because it's a very different kind of environment these days in comparison to what it was, I'd say, 20 to 30 years ago, where in any sort of medical decision making, it's extremely important to have the patient on board as a partner. Just because in the past, I think there was a lot of prescriptive medicine that happened. And these days, it's so clearly not the way to go, because I think you can only achieve the health outcomes that you want to when patients are completely on board, understand, and completely participate in decision making. And so, you know, obviously, this is exactly the case for research as well. I think patients should always have a voice in every step of the process. And I think there are a lot of things that clinicians and scientists absolutely cannot understand about, say, you know, recruitment or what it's like being in a clinical trial and how to disseminate information. And so I think we're finally beginning to recognize that as a field. And I think it's entirely appropriate and actually will enhance everything for patients to be partners in every step of the way, whether it's clinical or scientific.
Well, Dr. Jiwon Oh, thank you for all that you do, both in the lab and in the clinic, to improve the lives of people who are living with MS. And thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me, John.
While I'm heading to the CMSC annual meeting this week, there are a couple of upcoming online events that you may want to put on your calendar. On June 15th and 16th, the National MS Society is hosting the Black MS Experience Summit. We know being Black with MS carries its own set of unique challenges and experiences, from scientific and clinical differences in the disease itself, to inequities in the healthcare system, to cultural norms and customs that can get in the way of even being diagnosed. Some of the topics that are being discussed in breakout groups during the summit include MS diagnosis in the Black community, understanding clinical trials and studies, removing the stigma of mental health services, and nurturing your emotional and spiritual health. My friend Tyler Campbell is the MC of this year's event, and Tyler's story alone makes the Black MS Experience Summit a must-watch, must-participate-in event. If you're interested in finding out more or registering for this free event, you'll find a link in today's show notes. And Can Do MS is presenting a whole series of webinars throughout the year. The webinars take place on the first Wednesday of each month, and this Wednesday, June 1st, the topic is Bowel and Bladder, How to Find Confidence and Control. Brenda Miller-Blake and Lindy Schrainer are going to cover two of the most disruptive symptoms of MS, and social stigma makes them two of the least talked about symptoms of MS. During this program, you'll learn how MS affects bowel and bladder function and how your healthcare team can help you find confidence and regain control. You can find out more and register for this free event by visiting cando-ms.org/webinar, and you'll find that link in today's show notes. Starting a family is a big step for anyone. And when you're living with MS and you're taking powerful MS medications along with other symptom management medications, planning a family creates a lot of questions about what's safe and what isn't. I regularly receive questions from some of you about issues relating to conception, pregnancy, and the postpartum period. And joining me in a moment to take a deep dive into pregnancy and MS and to answer those questions is a clinician scientist and MS specialist in the Kaiser Permanente Health System, Dr. Annette Langer-Gould. Two-thirds of the people diagnosed with MS are women, and it's common for many women to receive that diagnosis at an age when starting a family may be on their minds. Joining me today to talk about pregnancy and MS is Dr. Annette Langer-Gould. Dr. Langer-Gould is a neurologist who specializes in MS at Kaiser Permanente, and we're going to tackle the questions that so many of you have on your minds. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Langer-Gould.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the question that I hear most often. Does getting pregnant make MS worse?
So that is probably, like you said, the first and foremost on most women's minds. And it's at first, I just want to reassure women that it is absolutely possible for you to get pregnant, you know, sail through pregnancy and the postpartum period and breastfeed. There is a treatment regimen out there for you that will make that possible. And the reason for that is because we now have a lot of different medication choices available for MS, several of which are absolutely compatible with getting pregnant and breastfeeding. But that makes the answer to that question a little more complex. And the two main things that drive the answer to that question are whether or not your disease was well controlled. And if so, did you require natalizumab, fingolimod, or another sphingosine phosphate receptor and a modulator, or I call them MOD drugs, so drugs that are similar to fingolimod to control your disease. So for women whose MS was well controlled, and by that I mean in the 2 years prior to pregnancy, they either were on no treatment or they were on glatiramer acetate or interferon beta or dimethyl fumarate, and they didn't have any relapses and they didn't have any new disease MRI disease activity, or they weren't on any treatment. So we do see that quite frequently now too. They had their first baby, they didn't have any trouble, so they don't go on any therapy in between. If you're well controlled on those, the risk of having a relapse during pregnancy is lower than prior to pregnancy. And the risk of having an MS relapse returns to sort of your pre-pregnancy baseline in 6 to 12 months postpartum. So you sort of pick up where you left off, but we no longer see that rebound relapse disease activity in women whose disease activity is well controlled prior to pregnancy in that early postpartum period, like the old studies from over 20 years ago show. If your disease was not well controlled and you're on one of those medications, then it looks very similar to those old studies where it goes down during pregnancy and there's a bump in relapse risk in the first 3 to 4 months postpartum, and then you pick up where you left off. If your disease was well controlled on natalizumab or fingolimod and you stop it either in those 3 months or so before getting pregnant or when you find out you're pregnant, you have a super high chance of having a relapse during pregnancy. Over 60% chance of having a relapse during pregnancy in the postpartum period. That's compared to 25% in all other women, well-controlled or not well-controlled. And you have a high risk, 10% with natalizumab, 6% with fingolimod, of having a severe relapse, one from which you will have permanent trouble walking 1 year postpartum. So that's something that's totally new. We never saw that before. Usually, the type of relapse you have, if you even have one, is going to be very similar to what you had before. So people don't get catastrophic relapses during pregnancy or the postpartum period if they never had one before pregnancy, unless they were on natalizumab or fingolimod and stopped it to become pregnant. And then the third group is if you got pregnant on a B-cell depleting therapy, intermittent infusions of low-dose rituximab or ocrelizumab. These women have exceedingly low risks of having a relapse during pregnancy or the postpartum period, even if they don't take any infusions during pregnancy or the first 6 to 8 months postpartum.
If a woman does experience a relapse during pregnancy, does that relapse have any significant effect on the baby?
No, the relapse itself does not increase the risk of pregnancy loss or adverse pregnancy outcome. And again, outside of the setting of natalizumab or fingolimod cessation relapses, the risk of a catastrophic relapse is super low.
Many women have concerns about being on an MS medication while they're trying to get pregnant and during pregnancy. And we certainly heard your concerns, your warning about fingolimod and natalizumab, but are other MS medications safe to take while trying to conceive and then during pregnancy?
That's another really good question. There's a lot of data now that you can get pregnant safely and accidentally on interferon betas and glatiramer acetate. So you can take those until your pregnancy test turns positive and then just stop them. And there is no risk of, there is no risk to your pregnancy or to your baby. And again, the intermittent infusions of the B-cell depleting drugs, rituximab or ocrelizumab, because the way they work, so they're out of your body, even though your B-cells are still depleted. So they're, you don't actually have to take an infusion during pregnancy. You can just skip your every 6 to 12 month infusion while you're pregnant. So those are also drugs that you can take safely beforehand. There are no drugs that are proven safe during pregnancy, and there are certainly a group of drugs that you absolutely should avoid. And those are drugs that increase the risk of fetal malformations and pregnancy loss. And the top of this list are chemotherapeutic drugs, teriflunomide and cladribine. Both of these drugs, if you get pregnant accidentally on them, your baby will see that it's too late. You can't stop it. You can stop it, but your baby's already seen it. And there is an increased risk of major malformations. Fingolimod and the MOD drugs also are mild teratogens, but they're not. It's not to the same degree as the chemotherapeutic drugs.
What about men? Is it safe for them to be on MS medications while trying for a baby with their partner?
So in men, the two drugs that should be avoided are cladribine and teriflunomide, the chemotherapeutic agents. And it's basically because they can make the sperm funky. So the sperm, you know, in animal studies, they've shown that the sperm doesn't swim as well. And it also may increase the risk of infertility, particularly if they've used higher doses. So for teriflunomide, there's a special procedure that men and women can undergo. It's called a chelation therapy, basically get admitted to the hospital and they suck the teriflunomide out of your blood and they measure the blood levels. If you don't want to go through that procedure, then you have to stop the teriflunomide 2 years in advance. And for cladribine, it's 6 months. And so, you know, the men should not try and conceive for 6 months. The other thing for men is that, particularly for older age, you may want to consider banking your sperm if you're going to go on to cladribine or teriflunomide. My personal take is, why bother? We've got so many other treatments that are safer and more effective. If you're still at the age where you're thinking about having a family, starting a family, just pick a different treatment.
Some women worry that having MS will affect their chances of conceiving. Are conception rates any different for women living with MS compared to the general population?
That's a really good question, and that comes up a lot. They're not. So there is no, the MS itself does not decrease your fertility, both in men or in women. The one thing we have seen in many studies is that women with MS, particularly before highly effective therapies were available, they could get their disease under well controlled, that they would delay starting a family until they were older. And we do know that, you know, 35 and older, it is going to be harder for you to get pregnant.
Another question that I tend to hear fairly regularly, is there a higher risk of complications during pregnancy or complications for the baby after it's born if the mother's living with MS?
So the disease itself does not increase the risk of adverse pregnancy outcomes for or pregnancy loss for both the mom and the baby. The only exception to that sometimes is that if women who are essentially paralyzed or can't really walk, that they may have a little bit more difficulty recovering from epidural anesthesia. But that's the only, it's not like they don't recover. It just takes a little bit longer.
While we still don't know what causes MS, we know that there's a genetic component involved. And some women who are living with MS worry about passing MS onto their child. Can you talk about the risk of children developing MS if they have a parent who's living with MS or a family history of MS?
Yes. So, you know, MS is primarily caused by environmental factors. We still don't really understand what they are. We know that getting, you know, low sun exposure and cigarette smoke increase the risk of MS. And there is a small genetic component. So the normal risk for anyone to get MS is about 1 in 800. If you have a parent with MS, it's about 1 in 100. So it is a little bit higher. But as the mother of three boys ranging in age from 17 to 22, there are much scarier things about having a baby. The number one thing that I worry about is their mental health and substance abuse. So the latest statistics from the CDC is that in high school, over 50% of kids report using marijuana in the last few weeks. And by the end of high school, 20% have reported using prescription drugs that were not prescribed to them. So they're getting it off the street, Xanax, Vicodin, Percocets, Valium. So to me, that's much more scary than a 1 in 100 chance of MS, particularly now that we've got great treatments for people with relapsing remitting MS.
Some of your team's research has shown that breastfeeding may protect women against postpartum relapses. What do women with MS need to know about breastfeeding?
Breastfeeding exclusively, or just so much so that you don't have your period doesn't come back, keeps your body in this sort of hormonally flat state that seems to have to work like a modestly effective treatment. So it is like a drug with a natural end date. The issue, though, is that eventually your baby is going to start taking most of its calories from table food. And at that point, your body won't be producing so much breast milk anymore. And your menstrual cycle will come back to normal, and your period typically comes back within 2 months. And when that happens, you sort of re-enter that mild pro-inflammatory state that fluctuates with your menstrual cycle. And it is likely that your disease will come back. So in one of our studies, we actually overlaid when women who didn't breastfeed at all, when they had their first postpartum relapse, with women started supplemental feedings in their baby, and the risk, the time from when they start supplemental feedings, whether it's right after birth or 9 months after birth, to their first postpartum relapse is identical. So that just sort of gives you more of an understanding of how that works. You do need to think about going back on a therapy at some point and trying to overlap that before you finish breastfeeding.
You know, earlier we talked about the effect of MS medications themselves and pregnancy. What about all those other MS symptom management medications? How should women manage them while they're considering pregnancy?
This is something that we often forget about when we get really hyper-focused on MS and the MS disease-modifying therapies, is that the drugs, the rule of thumb here is that if it's a small molecule, meaning it's in a pill, that means that if you get pregnant accidentally or you take it during your pregnancy, your baby will definitely see that drug. And a lot of the drugs that we prescribe are not for MS symptoms. So particularly seizure medications, which some women take for seizures, but a lot of them actually take it for pain control. Those drugs some of those drugs like Depakote or valproic acid, and to a lesser extent, Tegretol, can increase the risk of major malformations. So you definitely want to get off of those before you stop your birth control, particularly if they're, and try other types of symptom management, like non-pharmacological symptom management. Gabapentin, baclofen, those are all drugs we'd like to avoid. Stimulants. Some people take stimulants for their fatigue, modafinil and Adderall. Those are drugs you really want to come off of again before you stop your birth control, before you get pregnant. If you're on a seizure medication because you have seizures, then we would follow sort of the typical recommendations. So typically women will stay on those just at different doses during their pregnancy. And if you're on a antidepressant because you've had severe episodes of depression in the past, or you have bipolar disease, some of those are actually safe to take during pregnancy. And I would encourage you to talk to your psychiatrist about a risk of having a flare of your depression or your bipolar disease versus the small risks of some of the antidepressants. So many of those women will stay on their antidepressants throughout pregnancy and the postpartum period.
Pregnant women with MS sometimes wonder about umbilical cord blood donation. And probably the most common question I receive is, can a newborn's cord blood be used to benefit MS research?
So the short answer to that is no. There are very rare exceptions. So if you were exposed to one of these long-acting drugs while you were pregnant, so the infusion medication, so natalizumab, rituximab, ocrelizumab, ofatumumab, there are some groups that are looking at the, they want to see what the blood level is in the baby, if that drug is being concentrated in your baby's circulation. But other than that, there is no research going on to try and cure MS or be able to generate stem cells from your baby's umbilical cord blood. We do ask that you you donate it as a general research purpose. So there are researchers working on lymphoma and sickle cell anemia and other diseases. So, you know, if your hospital asks and it's possible, it would be very generous to donate it for general research purposes.
I heard you touch upon the answer to the question I was about to ask you with regard to umbilical cord blood donation. Is it worthwhile to bank that umbilical cord blood for the benefit of the mother or another family member who thinks they might be able to use the umbilical stem cells for future MS treatment?
Yeah, so the National MS Society website has great information about this, but the long and short of that is no. And I tell my patients about it. I mean, the way I see it is that you are going to be paying for that storage for an awfully long time, for about a 1 in 2 million chance that you may ever need it. And even then, whether it works, like if your child comes down with lymphoma in their 50s, will those umbilical cells still be able to be grown out to something that could potentially benefit them? We'll have medicine advanced so far that we don't need that anymore, and we've got great treatments for lymphoma. So, you know, you have to also remember that these blood banks, you know, they're for-profit entities, and they're looking for your money. And I think, you know, it's a big expense for most of us.
Well, I think we've covered everything from conception to postpartum. Dr. Annette Langer-Gould, thank you for all you do to improve the lives of people living with MS. And thanks for talking with me today.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/248. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or a text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes, and it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.